I'm going to be talking tonight about the chant that we did for our service called the Merging of Difference and Unity, or Merging and Difference and Equality, variously translated. In Japanese, it's also called the Sando Kai. But before I get into that, and I would like to mention that the topic is an unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma. I hope I can do it justice. But before I get into that, I wanted to mention that I've been marching this week. This past week, I've been doing some marching. And I haven't been doing much marching in recent years. And this week, I had got two opportunities to march. And it felt very good to be able to express myself with many others in the streets of Sacramento. You know, some people have the impression that a man of the cloth, a people of religion, should be quite equanimous about the affairs of the world. Perhaps even not pay attention to them too much. I think that might be kind of a luxury that some religious people have had over history. Things were peaceful in their land, and they had the opportunity, perhaps, because of this peace, and they were ruled by a good king. They had an opportunity to say, yeah, we really don't need to concern ourselves with the affairs of the world. We can retreat into our religious practice, and all will be well. And in fact, our religious practice will help the nation. So I think the latter is still true. But I don't think, you know, for us right now, this is a time to ignore or be unaware of the affairs of the nation. And so with many people this week who also felt that way, we were some of you were there at various marches this week. We expressed ourselves, and it was a wonderful opportunity. So there may be other occasions. Just letting you know. So as I say, the topic of my talk is the chant that we did tonight, the harmony of difference and equality. I think this chant goes along well with our theme. We have a theme for this winter, which is othering, or the capacity of human beings to create the other, and to imagine that there are other beings, and have feelings and of separation between ourselves and other beings. Doralee's been bringing out this theme, and I'm sure she's well into it now at the Green Gulch Farm, after closing in on the end of her 3-week intensive there. So this first I'd like to mention that the Sando Kai, I'd like to mention what the meaning of the title of that chant is. That's a Japanese word, of course. You know the translation, or various translations, the harmony of difference and equality, the merging of difference and equality, the harmony of difference and unity, variously translated like that. But just to go back, Japanese actually is a much simpler title in a way. San means three. That's the number three in Japanese. And Do is the number one. And Kai is this idea of harmony or merging. So the three and the one coming together, merging, unifying, not different, not separated from each other. Suzuki Roshi says, Kai, in Japanese, means to shake hands. So that's very nice kind of reference. The one, or the multiple, the three and the one, shaking hands, coming together in what? Perhaps agreement, perhaps friendliness, perhaps even love. You might say, well, why is this important, and what are we talking about, really? So we can elaborate more on the three and the one. The three is multiplicity of, the relative, the relative world, the world of the world that we can see with our eyes. Goodbye. You just push. Yeah, it's not locked. We haven't locked you in. Just push it, and you will be free. The three stands for the relative, the world that we can see with our eyes, hear with our ears, smell with our nose, taste with our tongue, touch with our body, and think about with our consciousness. So that's the meaning of San, world of multiplicity. It's the tangible world. We can call it a world. It's something we can feel like we can grasp. Something we can grasp. Stands for the world, and Suzuki Roshi actually calls it a world, but which is kind of interesting. I don't know how you can call it a world, because it's not anything effable. It's ineffable, and it's inconceivable. And for those of you who are familiar with the Heart Sutra, Do lines up with no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. So it's the world that can't be grasped. It's not a world, really. We could call it a world, but it's ineffable and ineffable and inconceivable. So it's hard to call it a world. So why is this important? Why is it important that there should be? Why should we get carried away and talk about these two merging or touching, and write poems about that possibility? And I think the answer is that there in various religions, including Buddhism, there are tendencies for people to think that religious experience is completely apart from and separate from and has no relationship with the material world. And in fact, what we need to do to truly have religious experience is separate from the material world. There's this idea in various traditions that the world is dragging us down. The material world is a burden, and we need to relieve ourselves of it through religious practice. And then you can get ideas like the early Buddhists did that the goal of spiritual practice is nirvana, which is translated extinction, blowing out, the end of experiencing. So the end of, no more of this, no more rebirths, no more material world. We move completely beyond that world. So then along come, you know, the Mahayana Buddhists, and they come along pretty early in the tradition, and they say, you know, that's not the way we see it. We don't think that that's going to. We think that turning our backs on the material world, thinking that that's something we need to escape from, is not helpful, and it's not actually what liberation is or what we want it to be, because we don't want it to be just something that we pursue for ourselves. We want it to be something that all beings can pursue. So we're not trying to get ourselves free, and you know, you old people, you know, you other people, you just take care of yourselves. We're developing a conception says that liberation can be and should be and is pursued in the midst of the material, in the midst of having a body and being in the world. That said, you can't just do that without practice. So we do have practice, and in that practice, what we do to aid this liberative adventure that we want to be on for ourselves and all beings, is we make this upright gesture. We make this upright gesture on our cushions and our chairs, and we make that gesture towards the absolute. We make that gesture towards the one. Now, we never can really reach the one. We can never really touch the one, because the one is ineffable. But we can make a gesture toward it. And so this upright sitting in our bodies is making a gesture towards the one, at the same time that we stay rooted in multiplicity. We don't turn away from multiplicity. So this poem, this Dharma poem, is basically saying in a whole bunch of different ways, it's basically talking about this not turning away from multiplicity and the virtue and value of understanding that spiritual experience is imminent. It's imminent, and it's experienced right here in our bodies. So one of the things that got me on this theme and wanting to talk about this was, excuse me while I drink something here, was in the fall. Some of you may remember that Ed Brown was here. And Ed Brown was here, and I don't remember if he was talking about this very phrase when he was here, but he did a one-day retreat, and he talked about this phrase that I'm about to mention when he was at that one-day retreat. And this is I should mention that the poem that we're talking about is written by in Japanese Sekito Kisen. He lived, but that's his Japanese name. He has a Chinese name, which is Shuto Sichuan, something like that. Sichuan. Not really good at pronouncing Chinese. O U. Shuto. Yeah. Chouteau. Yeah. That's my understanding of how you pronounce it. No Chinese people here, so we can't say. But Chouteau is the way I think it goes. And anyway, Chouteau wrote this poem, and he was a very important figure in our Zen tradition. He was only two generations after the sixth ancestor. And according to something I read somewhere, he actually met the sixth ancestor when he was like 12 years old. He goes back quite a long way. His dates are 700 to 790. And, of course, he lived in China. But Chouteau wrote some really brilliant stuff. We don't know too much else about him, but he wrote the Sandokai, which has, you know, survived down like 14th, 13th, 14th centuries now, and is chanted in Zen monasteries throughout the world. And he also wrote the Song of the Grass Hut, which some of you may be familiar with, which is a beautiful, beautiful poem. He actually lived as a hermit for some of his time. He didn't live always in a monastery. The Song of the Grass Hut is about living. We could have a whole other talk about that poem, but this is another quote, and this is a quote that Ed Brown brought forth that I had never heard about from Chouteau. Like, read the Harmony of Difference and Unity many times, chanted it many times, but I'd never heard this quote until I heard it from Ed Brown. And he quoted Chouteau as saying, Buddha mind, I think what he said actually was, Buddha, sentient beings, delusion, enlightenment, these are all words for the same thing. I think it's pretty much how Ed said it. And I had never heard that. Buddha, sentient being. I mean, I think I never heard it quite expressed that way, that these are all words for the same thing. That said, you know, I've heard the nature of sentient beings is Buddha. I've heard that. But I've never heard the words are all the words for the same thing. And so I wondered about this, and I wondered if I could actually read what a translation of what Chouteau said and see if. And so I did. I found it in a great book called Zen's Chinese Heritage. I found the quote, and the quote from Chouteau, the way Andy Ferguson translated, is a little different. That section of this passage says, Buddha mind, all beings, wisdom, and defilement. The names of these things are different, but actually they are one body. Oh, that's a little different. Actually, they are one body. So that's quite, it's close. It's close to saying the names are different, but actually they're the same. You know, maybe another translator would even say that. I don't know. But the remarkable thing was that today, in preparing my talk, I took the Princeton Buddhism of Dictionary, and I opened it. It's a big book. It's this thick. I opened the book, and I turned to a Chinese word called T-I. And that word literally means body. And I was like, how could this be? How could I have turned right to that word? And so then I read the definition of body, T in Chinese, and that's the literal meaning, there's how it's commonly used, and the common meaning of the word body is essence, the essence. That puts a little bit of different spin on it. if you read it like Buddha mind, all beings, wisdom and defilement, the names of these things are different, but actually they are one essence. One essence. It's close, I think, to same thing, one essence. But body conveys something. I mean, it's a little more evocative, at least in English. It's a little more evocative when we say when we hear body, and it also reminds us that, I mean, it's hard not to think of your own body, and it's also not hard not to think of your body in zazen. It seems to me, for a Zen student, you think of your body in zazen. If you were ever going to have a gnosis, a knowing that that Buddha mind and all beings are of one essence, it doesn't seem usually you might think that you were going to have that gnosis sitting upright in samadhi. That's where it might occur to you that this is actually true, that this is actually what's happening, and where you might feel the truth of that identity, feel the truth of that identity. The other terms that I encountered in my study for this talk were two other interesting Chinese terms. And one is Zheng, which is Z-H-E-N-G. Z-H is pronounced a J sound, Zheng. And the literal meaning of that word, well, and that is the word. So the Sandokai is about the merging of the absolute and the relative, right? That's the general overall term we use. The word for absolute in Chinese is Zheng. And as it turns out, the literal meaning of the word Zheng is upright. Upright. So, wow, I was very impressed. So this is where I think, you know, I think I said earlier, you know, in Zazen we make this gesture toward the absolute. We make this upright gesture toward the absolute, and that really seems to make sense to me. And then the word for the relative in Chinese is pian, and it means askew or tilted. So, you know, and you know, Dogen says, you know, in Zazen when we take our posture, don't lean to the left, don't lean to the right. Don't lean forward. Don't lean backward. Don't be askew. In Zazen, take a break from the relative, your engagement with things. You have an opportunity to take a break from your engagement with things. I was thinking about it, and it seems to me that most of us have a preference for engaging with things. You know, I mean, I think the great ones, you know, the great teachers and the great sages, they actually don't have a preference for things. They kind of lean the other way. They more have a preference for no thing. But I think generally when you live in the world, you kind of have a preference for things. And that's not bad, but it is a little distracting and hard to pursue a spiritual path if we're too wrapped up in things. If we're too wrapped up in things, we're likely, it's more likely that we will go askew. We will get too balled up in the relative. And of course it's inevitable, you know, some of us have to work, and it's hard to work and not be involved are relative things. You know, we have to like keep this Dharma Center going, right, Linda? And we, and it, this involves many, many engagements with things. Yeah. I was out here yesterday sweeping the parking lot with six stalwart Buddhist practitioners. And so a lot of engagement with the relative. And I notice this in myself, you know, like I notice that I'm kind of sometimes like prefer to engage with my little tasks and do my little this and do my little that and fix my little this and fix this other thing and, you know, do all these things. And so we kind of lean a little bit, you know, and that's what leaning is, you know, that's what, you know, being engaged with a relative, we kind of want to be in the relative. So what the Sando Kai is doing is saying, well, where it's at, guys, where it's at is in this merging, is in, you could say balance, you could say not forgetting your zazen, you could say, you know, engaging with the sangha and so forth. So this doesn't give me very much water. How am I doing? Okay. So I think I'll talk a little bit about the central metaphor of the Sando Kai, which is light and dark. When we chant the Sando Kai, there's many references to light and dark. And it says, for instance, right in light, there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. Right in darkness, there is light, but don't see it as light. We understand that darkness is a metaphor for the absolute. And why is it a metaphor for the absolute? Because when we're in great darkness, imagine if we turn out all the lights in this room, for instance. When we're in great darkness, there's only one thing. There's only the open. This is like related to the. Let us say this metaphor is related to the visual sense. Okay, so when we're in great darkness, then there's only one thing, and that's black. That's our perception. It's just black. And those, you know, even though we know there's objects in the room, the only direct perception is black. So it's just one thing. Objects all disappear. And so that's like dough, right? That's like the dough of Sando Kai. That's why we're using darkness here. And light, of course, in light, we see Barbara, Yvonne, Linda, Karen, and so forth. And we see the multiplicity of objects. So it's related to the visual sense. There's a kind of admonition, I think, in this phrase, right in light, there is darkness, but don't see it as darkness. That is, he's saying that, which is his theme, is that the absolute and relative are constantly interpenetrating. They're constantly interdependent. The absolute and relative are always interdependent. Zuki Roshi's analogy of the absolute and relative, he says it's like your body and your skin. How can you separate? There's no separation from your body and your skin, between your body and your skin. You can't find a boundary. So that's how Zuki Roshi says the relative and the absolute are just, you know, always joined, always communing, as it were. But it says, right in light, there is darkness. So right in this, you know, multiplicity of people and lights and walls and so forth, there is the absolute is here. It's here. But don't see it as darkness. So I don't know if you've ever run into anybody that I always think of it like this. Sometimes I run into somebody and they like to tell me about the great spiritual experience that they've had, or some great insight, some great or we're just talking about the rug, and the person's like, yeah, the rug is like the skin covering my body, and like it's like the absolute and the relative merging, you know. So, you know, we should, I always think of it like this, you know, don't confront it as darkness. You know, when we're just in the relative world, then we understand that there's something ineffable supporting and interpenetrating everything from moment to moment, but we don't carry on about it. We don't carry on about it or make it a thing. Anyway, I could be wrong about my understanding of that. So you could tell me when we have some questions. But then there's also this wonderful phrase in the Sandokai. This says after he talks about light and dark and their relationship, he says they're like the front and back foot in walking. They're like the front and back foot in walking. And I think that's just and Suzuki Roshi also thinks that's such an elegant analogy or metaphor. Because you can't have walking without the front and back foot, right? The front foot goes forward. The other foot has to go back, or you can't have walking. You know, so, and then the other foot goes forward. Well, the other foot has to go back. So this is very organic, right? And what the poem is saying is this is the way delusion and enlightenment work. This is the way Buddha mind and sentient beings work. So I think this is extremely comforting, really, because you don't have delusion, you don't have enlightenment without delusion. You don't get enlightenment without delusion. They're like the forward and backward steps in walking. So this is why Zuki Roshi can say at some point in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, a weed is a treasure. Your problems, your delusions, your difficulties are a treasure, because you can't go forward. They say actually, you know, that it's a problem. If you don't have any problems, it's hard to go forward in spiritual practice. You need something. You need the back foot, as it were. So, you know, we should really be. This is telling us, you know, be grateful for your delusions. Be grateful for your problems. They're what, together with enlightenment, together with awakening. This is what is impelling you forward. Like the front and back steps in walking. So one of the things this came to me when I was kind of sitting with this talk, and I thought, well, I think sometimes we think delusion is like disqualifying. Like if we have delusion, we think, I'm such a mess. You know, I am such a mess. I'm really not qualified. I'm really not qualified for, I shouldn't even go to the Zen group. You know, I'm such a mess. I'm really not qualified. And then if we have some insight, we think, I'm qualified. I'm really good. I should get up and, you know, tell everybody about my enlightenment. You know, so I think we sometimes think about it that way. I think especially the disqualified part. I think it's easy to fall into that and say, yeah, the way I am is kind of disqualifying. So anyway, I don't think that's the way to look at it. And I think that's not the way Sekito Kisen wants us to look at it. It's more like the front and back steps in walking. Okay, I see that I get angry when my spouse moves a piece of furniture without my help. I see that, I also see that I got angry when that happened. So there's, you know. But is that disqualifying? So I see those things, but and then after some things happen, I apologize, but I don't then carry that and think I'm disqualified. Well, that's my practice anyway. I don't want to say, well, now I'm disqualified and I should just, you know, not, I shouldn't even give the talk on Monday because I got angry this week. You know, I did get angry this week. I confess this, and but you know, the front and back steps, I just have to keep going forward. What can I do? Well, I'm getting close to the end, but I wanted to read you another story about Chouteau. I think this is also in Andy Ferguson's book, I believe. And this is a very short interaction between him and a teacher called Dawu, both very important teachers. And Dawu asked, what is the great meaning of the Buddha Dharma? Chouteau said, not attaining, not knowing. Dawu asked, is there anything beyond this? Chouteau said, the sky does not obstruct the white cloud's flight. Is there anything beyond this? The sky does not obstruct the white cloud's flight. So, you know, I think what we're doing in Zazen, in our Zazen practice, is we're cultivating a mind that does not obstruct delusion. If delusion is present, then delusion is present. We are also cultivating a mind that does not obstruct enlightenment. We're not unqualified for enlightenment. We are available for enlightenment. We're not obstructing enlightenment. We're not obstructing delusion. We're also cultivating a mind that does not obstruct a self, and a mind that does not obstruct others. So, what Darlene, Trish's wonderful teacher, who has left this world said, what is it that you're always telling me? She said, let others be others. Let others be others. Let others be others. So that's not obstructing others. Don't obstruct others. Let others be others. This is a great teaching. That one teaching carried forth into the world. Everyone will love you if you're like that. Everyone will love you. Just be like that. Don't obstruct them. Let others be others. Maybe I'll close. I'd like to read you this whole passage from this is really kind of just wonderful Dharma words that I'd just like to read you from this is Andy Ferguson's translation of this that includes this passage about Buddha mind, all beings, wisdom, defilement are the same. That's the way anyway, or one body. So this is the whole passage. It says, Zen master Shikuan, that's Shirto, that's his last name, Shikuan, entered the hall and addressed the monks, saying, my Dharma gate was first taught by former Buddhas. I don't say you need to practice some advanced form of meditation. Just see what the Buddha saw. This mind is Buddha mind. Buddha mind, all beings, wisdom, and defilement. The names of these things are different, but actually they are one body. You should each recognize your miraculous mind. Its essence is apart from temporary or everlasting. Its nature is without pollution or purity. It is clear and perfect. Common people and sages are the same. This mind reaches everywhere without limit. It is not constrained by the limits of consciousness. The three realms and the six realms manifest from this mind. If this mind is like the moon reflected in water, where can there be creation and destruction? If you can comprehend this, then there is nothing that you lack. So, you know, I think what we're up to here is cultivating a mind that's like the moon reflected in water. And when you have that mind, you're going to let others be others. Others will be really happy with you. But don't be like me and come home and find that the other has moved the furniture without my participation. Don't be like that. Just come home and say, darling, I see you've moved the furniture. I wasn't expecting that. How did that go for you? So, you know, keep up our practice until we get it right, I guess, you know. Till we get it right. Someday maybe we'll get it right. But maybe not. But that's okay. You know, it's okay. So, would you like to raise some questions or thoughts or inquiries about the Sando Kai? This, I will say, while you think about that, every person in this Sangha should read this book. branching streams flow in the darkness. This is Suzuki Roshi's lectures in the summer of 1970, which I'm going to go to my grave thinking I might have heard one of them, because I was in Tassajara. These were given at Tassajara, and I was in Tassajara in the summer of 1970 as a wayfaring hippie, not as a Zen student. And I heard a talk in the Zendo, the old Zendo in Tassajara. So I'm gonna tell you that I heard one of these talks. I'll never know for sure, but in any case, this book is a wonderful book. They took, I think, some liberties. This was put together by Mel Weitzman, who's the abbot of Berkeley Zen Center, and Michael Wenger, who was a longtime student at San Francisco Zen Center. And I think they took some liberties with Suzuki Roshi's syntax, more than in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Some of it just reads too much like a kind of erudite English speaker, native speaker. But not much of it, just like the beginning part. And most of it, you still hear Suzuki Roshi's voice. To take a copy of the Sando Kai, well, actually, you don't even have to have a copy, because it's a quatrain by quatrain, is that the right word? Four lines by four line exposition of the poem. So it's quite accessible, and some of it's, puzzling, but most of it is quite accessible, and I highly recommend. I have an autographed copy. I looked at that and I said, what do you mean I have an autographed copy? It's by Suzuki Roshi. It was published in like 1990 or something, but it's autographed by Mel Weitzman. He was the editor. Karen. Right.
And the reason I'm asking that is that in the real world, we have to interact with others sometimes you have to stand up for yourself or something.
Yeah. Well, I hope that letting others be others doesn't sound like roll over for others, or do what others tell you to do, or anything like that. I don't think that's what was meant there, but it applies to those situations when, I think, especially when others aren't doing what you want them to do, which is part of the reason that I was out there marching. It applies to that situation. It's a good question. It's a really good question. How do you let others be others if you perceive there's some harm? If you perceive that there's another that is going to do injury. So we have to really be alert in that situation. I think really, really be alert. Yeah, Trish. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
go there so that we can ourselves, our own attachment. So it's a little different than trying to touch somebody who is kind of involved with whatever the others, but allow them to have theirs, and then some find some equanimity or something in between.
Well, you know, it's kind of become a trope or one of those things. But when somebody says something, and you say, "What I hear you saying is," and you know, "What I hear you saying is, you want to build a wall and you want to separate one people from another, even though." I see that these people are interdependent with each other and they need each other. So could you talk to me a little bit more about your wall? You know, I mean, that would, you know, I hear you saying such and such. Let the other person say, yes, that's what I'm saying, or no, that's not quite. It's maybe a little bit overused, but it's still a pretty powerful way to approach another with whom you might want to start marching, you know, marching about some of the things that they're saying. Yeah. Oh, Yvonne. Right.
So our job is not just to stay silent.
No.
So it's coming from a place of justice and compassion and love. So sometimes that requires action too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Following the precepts. Yeah, Jeff.
I just thought of just this moment of a very extreme example. I don't know that it's been typified as being the wrong thing to do, and I've even heard it used as kind of a glorified example, but during the Vietnam War, there's at least one instance where a specific monk
More than one instance, yeah.
Yes, he had, and they had felt so strongly that they had to do something, and that was what they decided to do. I know it takes a long time, I think it was the one that we've all seen probably on Israel. So I don't think it's unusual or extreme for Buddhists to protest something they think needs the action.
No, and actually there's an incomprehensible to me practice in Southeast Asia of monks immolating various parts of their body. And I don't know enough about it, but it's something that has gone on for centuries, actually. And monks will, for instance, burn off a hand. So it's a practice that is incomprehensible to, I think, you know, Western culture, but I can't really say anything about it other than, you know, in that instance of that monk, I think there's a especially famous monk who did that self-immolation. It had a powerful anti-war impact and helped galvanize the anti-war movement in in the U.S. When people saw that, maybe he knew that would happen, and he was obviously he was prepared to make that ultimate sacrifice. But it's hard to imagine, but
it seems
definitely extreme. But how extreme is dropping napalm from planes? We're going to have, as part of this this winter program, we're going to have Alan Sanaki here for February 13th, I believe, and he's going to be giving a talk about basically social action and some of the work he's been doing with the Dalits in India. That should be quite compelling, and I think he's going to talk to us about, you know, kind of the social action part of our practice. For myself, I was involved in social action before I, you know, became a Buddhist, and I suppose combined with, you know, realizing for myself that there was so much I needed to work on. So I was not the person that I wanted to be, that I kind of had to hold back on social action for a while, and address myself and work on myself. But then I got to Tassajara. Oh my goodness, we're going to stop. I got to Tassajara, and the Roshi there was talking about, this was in 1983, and it was, I think, the height of, like, talking about nuclear weapons, and there was a great renewed fear of nuclear holocaust at that time. And so we started doing social action at Tassajara, and the way we manifested that was in the summer by going and sitting on the outside walkway of the Zendo at lunchtime when we weren't working. We go sit out there in the 100-degree heat, and we didn't put up a sign or anything. We just said whoever wanted to go up and sit in. It was kind of like the sitting that they had here the other day at the day of the inauguration. We had a sitting here, and it was just to take some time to make that gesture toward the absolute at that time, and make that gesture toward the precepts at that time, make that gesture toward not killing, toward not harming, toward nonviolence. And that's, you know, when we take this posture, we are making that gesture. This is a gesture toward nonviolence, non-harming, not killing, not stealing, not misusing sexuality. That's the gesture we're making. And whether that, you know, our understanding is whether that gesture can be seen by those in power or not, we still need to, you know, we still need to make that gesture. Or it's still a good idea anyway. It's still a good idea. We don't need to do it, but if we want to do it, it's a good idea. Thank you very much.